Good morning. It is always good to be back in El Campo, Bay City area, the old stomping grounds, and I just hope you remember me for who I am today, not who I used to be. We're going to be in a minute, we're going to be in the book of 1 Samuel in chapter 1. You will need a Bible today. We are going to chew through a lot of scripture, and we're going to do it very rapidly. John told me I only had 50 minutes to preach, and so I'll make sure and give you that full time. Or maybe that was Bible class. I get confused sometimes. But, you know, during the holiday season, it's interesting. I do counseling, and then I also do youth ministry. And during the holiday season, the youth ministry kind of goes down in attendance, and people are busy. They're trying to finish up their semesters. They're trying to get ready for the holidays, and so kids don't come to class as often, and you know, parents kind of miss church because it's getting dark at night earlier on Wednesday nights, and it's getting cold. It's hard to get out of bed. But what's interesting is when that goes down, counseling goes up. Now, I cannot figure out for the life of me why people need more counseling during the holidays. Something about dysfunction in our families tends to drive us towards help. Now, does anybody in here have dysfunction in their family? Because I don't. My family, there is no dysfunction in it at all. I mean, we are just as perfect as we come, and that's when I live by myself. You know, holidays are tough. The holiday times can be really tough. You know, this year for me, I in the anticipation of coming to Thanksgiving, started thinking about my family and my extended family, and realized my grandmother is not going to be here for this holiday season. And my other grandmother is really not here, even though she's still alive mentally, for this holiday season. So for me, it's a little bit of a sad time. For some others, it's a frustrating time because that one family member, you know, that one that's going to be at the meal, and if you don't have that one, it's you. Just sorry to tell you that, but that one family member that's going to be there, you just kind of dread having around sometimes. They're always going to be there, and it can be a frustration. And what I've noticed over the years in doing counseling is right before Thanksgiving, I get phone call after phone call after phone call, can you get me in now? And most of those are, we need to separate, and can you help us survive the holidays so that when January comes, everybody can be happy and everybody can have a wonderful time, and then in January we'll let the bad news out and we have 9 more months before we see anybody we know. And then it goes dormant. And I begin to ask this question about dysfunction in families. And I kind of wonder, has there ever been a dysfunctional family that God has used? And so I go back to the Bible and I think, I know, I'll start with the best family that could ever exist. The one, you know, where God is the actual father, Adam and Eve. And I think, this has got to be a family with no dysfunction. But man, the first meal we come to in the text. I mean, Cain's bringing in the fruit. Abel's bringing in the meat. We're sitting around the Thanksgiving meal. We're sharing our food together. And then what happens next? War breaks out, somebody dies. Let's jump ahead a little bit. I love the stories in Genesis, right? Let's go to the next functional, dysfunctional family, right? Noah. I mean, really, God, this is the guy you're going to pick to save the world. I mean, look at it. It all looks great and wonderful until you get past the flood, and what happens next is Noah plants a vineyard and gets drunk, lays around naked. Youngest son comes in and sees him. He curses him for all eternity. I mean, this is how the Bible gets going. How about we jump ahead to Abram? Abram's a great one, right? Promise he's going to have the seeds of many nations. He's going to be the most blessed human that has ever existed. And what's he go off and do? He sleeps with his wife's maid, has a child, Ishmael, then has another child, Isaac, tries to murder him on an altar. Can you just imagine for a second Christmas dinner with these guys? You know, you got Hagar over here hanging out, and she's probably not allowed to sit at the table, but Ishmael would definitely be at the table. I mean, he's the firstborn, and then you got Isaac over here, and he's, you know, got his mom probably whispering in his ear. And, I mean, I can just imagine how this has gone for the last 5,000 years, give or take. Jump ahead a little farther, and what family do you run into next? I mean, you got Isaac, right? Isaac has two boys. Of course, he's come from a great family, great dad, right? And then he's got these two wonderful sons. You've heard of them, Jacob and Esau, right? No dysfunction at all in that family. I mean, one of them is so dysfunctional, he even wars with God. Fights him, wrestles him all night. And the story goes, and the story goes, and you know, and I thought about talking to you a little bit about the judges. We could spend all day in the judges. You talk about, I mean, just Samson alone. I mean, this guy can't marry the right woman. I mean, I can just imagine when he brings home this woman for the meal, for the annual feast, for whatever's going to happen, that it's just peachy. Everybody's happy to see her. I mean, you're still with this? Do you know what she just did to you? I mean, imagine the side conversations that are going on as the meal ends and as people kind of break out, right? I mean, you just imagine this, right? This is the Bible. Dysfunction Junction. Now, we're gonna sit for a second in 1 Samuel chapter 1 because this is the opportunity for transformation and change, you know, because you get these texts and you got the creation narrative and all these families, and then you get into the judges and you got people coming out of slavery in Egypt, and they're in the promised land, and it's wonderful, and God has redeemed his people. This is the opportunity for change. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be wonderful. 1 Samuel chapter 1. Let's see how this one starts off here. There was a certain man of Ramathim, a Zephite from the hill country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, son of Jeroham, son of, I'm going to stop with the names. This gets difficult here in a second. Verse 2. He had two wives. Any dysfunction going to happen in this one? I mean, really, two of them? One's more than enough, right? I mean, that's where all the dysfunction comes from, is the wives, right? Women, help me out here, right? Yeah. One of them was Hannah, and the name of the other was Peninnah. Peninnah had children, but Hannah had no children. Now, this man used to go up year by year from his town to worship and to sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh, where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests of the Lord. Now, I would love to spend time talking to you about Eli and his two sons, but I can't get through all of the dysfunction that comes out of these guys. These are some bad news bears. These boys do not get it, and they're priests, okay? Let's keep reading. Verse 4, on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to his wife, Peninnah, and to all her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, what's the text say? He gave a double portion. I mean, I can tell you where this story is going to go. You're going to favor one wife over the other wife? What's going to happen between these two women? But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. Her rival used to provoke her severely to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So it went on year by year. As often as she went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. Now, let's paint the picture a little bit here. You've got three characters in this story right now. You've got Elkanah, Hannah, and Peninnah, right? Elkanah and Hannah get married, probably, can't have kids. And so Elkanah, being a good Jewish Israelite person, says, I'm supposed to procreate and reproduce, says, I'm going to marry Peninnah. Marries Peninnah. Peninnah has kids. All three of these people do what every year? Celebrate the Lord's grace and thanksgiving that's upon them. They go up and they sacrifice. They go to the annual celebration. These are good Jewish people, all three of them. One of these people, Elkanah, is such a blessed man that he spends his time trying to bless his two wives, even the one who, for all intents and purposes, has something majorly wrong with her. She's done something evil in her past. Something is not right because the God, the Lord of hosts, is not blessing her with children. It looks bad from the outside. His other wife, most likely his second wife, is doing everything right. She's blessed beyond blessing. She's got multiple kids. She gets a blessing every year from her husband. And what does she do with her blessing? What every good follower of the Lord does, shows off her blessing at the expense of those who aren't blessed. I mean, right? All of this that she has, and what does it say that she does every single year when they go to the big feast? Look what I got. Count them. You don't got nothing. Why are you even celebrating? Why did you even come with us on this trip? I mean, really? But this is what she does, right? And Hannah, year after year after year, this one, I imagine she contemplates suicide. I imagine she contemplates just leaving. I imagine she contemplates a whole lot of bad things. Maybe even lying about somebody's kids and trying to get them cut in half. I mean, we know that story comes in the future because she can't have any and she wants to look like she's had. I can see her doing all number of things, but this woman is faithful. But from the outside, she does not look very blessed. Let's continue reading. Verse 8. Her husband Elkanah said to her, "Hannah, why do you weep? Why do you not eat? Why is your heart so sad? It is a festival. It is a time of joy. What is wrong with you, sweetheart? Am I not more than 10 sons to you? Am I not the best thing that you've ever had in your life? Don't I not give you everything you could possibly want? Why are you so sad?" Verse 9. And after they had eaten and drunk at Shiloh, Hannah rose and presented herself before the Lord. Now, the local preacher Eli was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple of the Lord. Hannah was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. Now, under her breath, she made this vow, "O Lord of hosts, if only you will look on the misery that I exist through, this servant life that you have given me, and remember me and not forget me, and I will give your servant a male child. Then I will set him before you as a Nazirite until the day of his death. He shall drink neither wine or any intoxicants, and no razor shall touch his head." And as she continued under her breath praying before the Lord, Eli looked over and observed her. Hannah was praying silently. Only her lips moved, but her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli thought she was drunk. I guess silent prayers were weird back then. But Eli, this pastor, this preacher, this guy that's supposed to have this grace inside of him and look on people in distress, looks over at her in her misery and thinks that she has been drinking too much. This must have been the party of parties that goes on. Because for him to be able to sit there at the edge of the temple, look over and go, "She's drunk," that must be what's pretty norm of the area. It's time to celebrate God. We come together, we drink wine, we eat lots of food. This is a grand annual celebration. He looks over at her and misjudges her and says to her in verse 14, "How long will you make a drunken spectacle of yourself? Put away your wine." But Hannah answered, "No, my Lord, I am a woman deeply troubled. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as worthless, for I have been speaking out of great anxiety and vexation all of this time." Then Eli answered. Something changed. Eli answers, and this is what he says, "Go in peace. The God of Israel grant the petition you have made." And she said, "Let your servant find favor in your sight." And the woman went to her quarters, ate and drank with her husband, and all her countenance was sad no longer. Now, it's a good story, right? This woman looks drunk. She's already having a bad life. She can't have kids. She's sad. Everybody around her celebrating. She's in the midst of it all. And while all that's going on, to even add more frustration to her life, her competition, the other wife, the other the other part of the family as picking on her 24/7 about how bad her life is. She goes to the temple, a place to find solace, a place to connect with God. And the very person there who's supposed to love her, to bless her, to give her grace, judges her as a drunk. And from the context of the text, as a woman who is worthless. And she says this, "I'm confused. I'm not drunk. I don't know what to do with my life. This sadness just won't go away." And then Eli speaks some words to her, and she goes away, and her whole attitude has changed. She begins to live as a woman blessed. Nothing in her life's changed. This is the crazy thing about the text. He didn't fix anything. It doesn't say she had kids. It doesn't say that her rival died and all the kids died and she looked good. It doesn't say that she inherited a whole bunch of stuff or was able to adopt. Nothing in her life has changed. Nothing. Luke chapter 10. You don't have to go there. I can tell you the story. But if you want to, you're welcome to. Jesus, this guy who's come from the most dysfunctional family in the New Testament. I mean, this family has also got its own set of problems. I mean, the husband was about to divorce the wife because she got pregnant before they were married, right? They had to then flee to Egypt, and they had to lie about who they were because if they were caught by Herod and his people, they would have killed Jesus, right? Then we know Jesus had brothers. I can't imagine what that meal was like. "Yes, I am the Messiah." "Oh, really?" You know, James probably going at him left and right. Now we know that kind of changes a little bit later in time, but I can just imagine the meals that were going on and this poofed up head guy sitting there going, "I've never sinned, have you, James?" And just picking, you know, I don't know what that would have looked like, but I can imagine that. But Jesus, now with his dysfunctional crew of followers, says it's time to train them. What are they going to do with their lives when I'm gone? How are they going to function and move forward? And in Luke chapter 10, we get the first glimpse of what Jesus wants them to do, and it's very, very simple. He says to them, "Forget everything you have. Go out where I will go soon and say these words to people. Peace be with you." Go out and bless. Go out and speak hope into people. Go out and speak a good word into them, and soon I will come. And if they don't want to listen to you, that's fine. Leave. But if they listen to you, stay there and just continue to be a blessing. Continue to say nice things to these people. Don't change their lives. Don't try to fix anything for them. Don't try to make things better. Just be a word of blessing to them. And it says in Luke chapter 10 that these guys then came back later rejoicing. They went out with a very simple task: to speak good news into people, to just bless them. Not to fix anything. Jesus was going to come later. They ended up fixing some things. They ended up having some demons cast out and healing the sick and doing some other things, but that wasn't their mission. Their mission was to be a word of blessing. Eli figured this out, happenstance-wise. In 1 Samuel, as he speaks a word, as he could do the only thing that he knew to do at this point, a man who sits in a life with dysfunction with his two sons who aren't doing so hot, speaks a word to a woman. Her life changes then, and later she becomes pregnant and has kids. And the first one she has is Samuel, and she does exactly what she said she was going to do. She follows through on the promise. There's a story that I heard the other day from a guy who talked about this heart that we all have to give God back a portion of what he's given to us, that we pray that prayer, "God, if you will bless me, I will bless you." And there's a story of a farmer who had two cows. Have you heard this story? Okay, good. It's a preacher story. You sure you haven't heard it? He had two cows. And he felt so blessed. He goes into his wife and he says, honey, this cow had two calves and it's awesome. They're both there. They're amazing. We're going to be wealthy this year. This is so good. And then he has this moment. I prayed this prayer to God and I need to give him back one of these cows. And when it comes time to go to auction, I'm going to sell the one and give the money to God. That's what I'm going to do. And time goes on and it comes time to go to the auction. He goes out to the field and one of the calves is dead. And he goes back home, and he walks in sad to his wife. He says, what's wrong? She goes, God's cow died. And that's how it is for all of us, right? But in Hannah, we see an attitude, a perseverance, and an attitude of faith that even though she has the one child, she gives it back to the Lord like she said she would. He didn't bless her with two or three or four at this point. One. And it turns out that the blessing that Eli gave to a woman he thought was worthless and drunk, who looked to him as worthless and drunk, would be the woman who brought him a son that would redeem him and his line. That would be the name Samuel, who would become the first prophet in Israel and appoint kings. Eli was able to adopt a son given to him by God by a woman who only had one. Heard that story before? Hannah can do it. Surely God can do it with his kid. And Eli raises Samuel, and Samuel becomes the first person who it seems to be has this indwelling of a spirit about him, who then picks Saul, dysfunctional, who then picks David, dysfunctional, who then, with a second woman who wasn't his wife, has a kid, and God, out of that dysfunction, brings about Solomon, who then becomes the most powerful, wisest king to ever exist, who then has two sons, who end up splitting the kingdom, who then go on and on and on and on down to the Bible, one story after another, is family with dysfunction, but God brings grace out of the dysfunction through his people. Amen? It's the holiday season, folks. There's a lot of reasons to complain and argue. I interviewed my teens a couple weeks ago at a Devo, and I said, what's the number one thing that you are excited about with Thanksgiving and Christmas coming? And they chattered, and they chattered, and they chattered, and gifts, and this and that. And I said, what's the one thing that you are not looking forward to? And overwhelmingly, they all said some of the conversations around the table. I said, well, what are some of those conversations going to be? And a couple kids in the back raised their hand, all about the elections. The Democrats this, the Republicans that, Obama this, you know, Trump that. And that's kind of sad. It's all going to be about ISIS and ISIL, and it's all going to be about these negative things that go on. And it's just a beating sometimes to be home. And I thought, interesting. What is our call as followers of Christ? Well, today's story from Hannah is not to get stuck in the dysfunction, not to carry on with the pessimism of Peninnah, this very blessed woman. We are blessed people. Our call from this story is to be like Eli. It's to recognize that we may have misjudged some people and speak a blessing into them. It's to recognize that we have a position of power with God and that our position should be to provide the grace that the dysfunction needs to thrive. That's our call. Some of you may feel like your dysfunction, your sin in your life, your own family may be too much for you to bear, and you may need prayer. And when we offer that, we'll have elders that can pray over you. I can say a prayer over you. Some of you may feel like you need more and more grace and just need to be surrounded and blessed. But I want to encourage you all that over the next 4 weeks, as the world gears up to celebrate, hopefully, Christ and not shopping, that people are hopefully celebrating the grace from God, not an idea called Santa, that you will remember your call too. And your call is not to change people's lives, not to fix people's brokenness, but just to say a word of blessing and let God do the rest. Amen? If you need anything at all, we can come now as we stand.